Jesus went out to the Mount of Olives. At daybreak, he reappeared in the temple area, and when the people started coming to him, he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees led a woman forward who had been caught in adultery. They made her stand there in front of everyone. "Teacher," they said to him, "this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses ordered such women to be stoned. What do you have to say about the case?" They were posing this question to trap him so that they could have something to accuse him of. Jesus simply bent down and started tracing on the ground with his finger. When they persisted in their questioning, he straightened up and said to them, "Let the man among you who has no sin be the first to cast a stone at her." A second time he bent down and wrote on the ground. Then the audience drifted away one by one, beginning with the elders. This left him alone with the woman, who continued to stand there before him. Jesus finally straightened up again and said to her, "Woman, where did they all disappear to? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she answered. Jesus said, "Nor do I condemn you. You may go, but from now on, avoid this sin."
If you're driving a car with a non-driver sitting next to you, it's almost certain that when you ask for a direction, your passenger will give it to you the exact moment you have to turn right or left, causing the driver behind to brake suddenly when he sees your indicator light. It's always a help to know a little in advance where exactly you're going next. Our Sunday Gospels often have something of the abruptness of those directions. On occasions they begin, "at that time." On others, we're plunged right into the action, like today. Jesus went out to the Mount of Olives. Went out from where? Unlike our driver, we know where he goes next, because we're told, at daybreak, he reappeared in the temple area. Ah, so he had been in the temple area, teaching and healing, presumably. But let's look at our New Testament. In the Jerusalem Bible, chapter 8 of John's Gospel begins, "And Jesus went to the Mount of Olives." But the previous chapter ends, "They all went home." Who were they? And what had been going on exactly? Let's set the scene. It's autumn, and in Jerusalem the Feast of Tabernacles is in full swing. Feast of Tents or Booths, Sukkot, from the Hebrew word for thickets or huts. But its original name was the Feast of Ingathering, and was the climax of the agricultural year, celebrating the final gathering in of the harvest and the vintage. It's mentioned in the two most ancient calendars, we're told, as we read in Exodus. "You must celebrate the Feast of Ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in the fruits of your labours from the fields." The New Jerome Bible Handbook tells us,
"Of the three annual pilgrimage feasts, this was the most important and the best attended. Like the feasts of unleavened bread and of weeks, the Feast of Tents was an agricultural feast. It marked the ingathering of all the produce of the fields, the products of the threshing floors, and of the wine and oil presses. When the earth had yielded all its bounty for the current year, and that bounty had been gathered and stored, the people gave joyful thanks to God. The analogy with Thanksgiving Day is obvious. There was dancing, singing, and general merriment, including, apparently, a generous sampling of the new wine. The ritual of the feast is described as a pilgrimage to the temple, and it lasted 7 days. From Numbers we learn what sacrifices were offered. In Leviticus, that for 7 days the people are to live in huts, in memory of how the Israelites lived after their liberation from Egypt, and to gather foliage from majestic trees, branches of palms, and boughs of myrtles and of valley poplars, and make merry before the Lord. Later historical texts make it clear that the foliage was carried in procession, as in the Palm Sunday ceremony. The feast began as a harvest festival, as its earliest name, Ingathering, suggests, and as the ancient texts indicate, even after it had taken on a name inspired by an accidental part of the ritual, huts, tents, tabernacles, or booths, it remained essentially an agricultural feast.
Until the advent of modern farm machinery, the bringing in of the last load of the corn of the harvest was always celebrated in England by the harvesters singing the Harvest Home song. For on that occasion, the farmer provided a supper known as a Harvest Home, which was followed by a general jollification. In the north of England, the celebration was called a mel supper, from the French mêlé, to mingle together. For on these occasions, wrote one chronicler in 1801, the servant and his master are alike, and everything is done with equal freedom. They sit at the same table, converse freely together, and spend the remaining part of the night in dancing and singing, without any difference or distinction. While the Jewish feasts of Passover and Pentecost have their Christian equivalents in our Easter and Pentecost, no similar feast of ingathering appeared until the year 1843, when the Reverend R.S. Hawker, vicar of Morwenstow in Cornwall, set aside Sunday, October the 1st, as a day to thank God for the harvest. The idea caught on, and the practice spread throughout the Church of England and is still popular today. Churches are decorated with corn, fruit, vegetables, and produce of all kinds, especially in country parishes. In 1844, Henry Alford wrote in his Harvest Hymn,
"Come ye, thankful people, come, raise the song of Harvest Home. All is safely gathered in, ere the winter storms begin."
And Eleanor Fargen, children's writer of the earlier 20th century, pictured the church scene.
"Turn the churches into bowers, little birds shall sing in, where the children sing their glee. God the Lord will bless the throng, lifting up its autumn song, gladly in thanksgiving."
And before we come to the serious matter of our gospel, let's listen to these lines from John Betjeman's Diary of a Church Mouse, in which the poet gives his own humorous impression of the festival, seen mainly from the mouse's point of view.
"For me, the only feast of all is autumn's harvest festival, when I can satisfy my want with ears of corn around the font. I climb the eagle's brazen head to burrow through a loaf of bread. I scramble up the pulpit stair and gnaw the marrows hanging there. It is enjoyable to taste these items ere they go to waste, but how annoying when one finds that other mice with pagan minds come into church my food to share, who have no proper business there. A large and most unfriendly rat comes in to see what we are at. This year he stole a sheaf of wheat. It screened our special preacher's seat. And prosperous mice from fields away come in to hear the organ play, and under cover of its notes ate through the altar's sheaf of oats. While I, who starve the whole year through, must share my food with rodents who, except at this time of the year, not once inside the church appear. Within the human world, I know such goings-on could not be so, for human beings only do what their religion tells them to. But all the same, it's strange to me how very full the church can be with people I don't see at all, except at harvest festival."
That year of 29 AD, Jesus did not go up to Jerusalem at the beginning of the Feast of Tabernacles. His brothers, cousins or other relations, urged him to go down into Judea. "Let your disciples see the works you are doing," they said. And as one writer put it, if he was ever to have a sensational success in Jerusalem, the Feast of Tabernacles provided the ideal setting. Frank Sheed tells us something of the spectacular quality of this feast.
On the first evening, golden lampstands were set up in the court of the women, a space open to everybody. These stands were enormous, 150 feet high, we are told, and as the lamps were lit, there was singing of canticles and playing of musical instruments. The sound of the music could be heard 20 miles away in Jericho. We read of a torch dance, with the highest dignitaries of Israel dancing to a set rhythm with lighted torches thrown high into the air and caught again. In every mind was the pillar of fire which had given light to the Israelites in the desert.
Although the feast had its religious significance, it was also clearly the opportunity for a great big party. On the eighth day, we read, the huts were abandoned and the whole day given to carnival. This was not what Jesus had come for. So he told his relatives, go up to the festival yourselves. I'm not going, because for me the time is not ripe yet. And so he stays behind in Galilee. But, we read, after his brothers had left for the festival, he went up as well, but quite privately, without drawing attention to himself. And it's not until the feast is nearly over that he goes up into the temple and teaches, declaring that he has come from God and that his teaching is God's. The guards are sent to arrest him, but they return to the priests and Pharisees empty-handed. Never did man speak like this man, is their only explanation. So you've been led astray as well, jeer the Pharisees. Have any of the authorities believed in him? No, only the mob, and they know nothing about the law. And does the law judge a man before he has had a hearing? Asks Nicodemus, who is also a Pharisee, but who has met and spoken with Jesus by night. Are you a Galilean too? He is taunted. Go into the matter, and you'll see. Prophets do not come out of Galilee. The Messiah, they knew, must be born in Bethlehem, the city of David. But Jesus is never quoted as mentioning his birthplace. And it's at this point that the party breaks up. They all went home, and Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Night has fallen. But next morning, he's back again in the temple area. At daybreak, we heard. Other versions have simply early in the morning. Perhaps he's still coming down the hill as the city ramparts light up with the first rays of the sun, which rises over Jerusalem from behind the Mount of Olives. This is slightly higher than the city, 826 metres, we're told. As he descends, he sees in front of him the towering white and gold mass of the temple. A priest comes out on a pinnacle, as he does every morning, to look towards the east and report, "The sun is shining already." And the assembled priests cry out, "Is the sky lit up as far as Hebron?" And the watcher responds, "It is lit up as far as Hebron." And shortly afterwards, there's a shrilling of silver trumpets to announce that the first sacrifice of the day has been offered on the altar of burnt offerings. The smell of incense fills the air. The temple courtyards are still in shadow, but there are people about, despite the early hour. The pilgrims who have come up for the feast spend as much time as they can at the temple. And this particular feast was attended by women also. Men were required by the law to appear before the Lord 3 times a year. The women apparently went with them on some occasions, but were not obliged to. In a Bible handbook, we read,
as head of the family, the husband or father presented the sacrifice and offerings on behalf of the entire family. But the wife might also be present. Women attended the Feast of Tabernacles, the yearly feast of the Lord, and the festival of the new moon. By New Testament times, the Jewish women had stopped being active in temple or synagogue worship.
And significantly for our gospel episode today is this next sentence.
Although there was a special area at the temple known as the court of the women, women were not allowed to go into the inner court.
And it is in the court of the women that we find Jesus, sitting on a low bench or stool, probably, teaching the crowds that are already thronged to him. Then there's a sudden hush and drawing back as a woman is pushed in amongst the crowd by a group of scribes and Pharisees. She has been caught in adultery. The spies had certainly been out that night. How many other infidelities had been committed during this time of feasting? We're only told of one. Writes our handbook,
the Hebrews considered adultery a serious threat to the family, so they punished adulterers swiftly and harshly. A man and a woman caught in the act of adultery must both die by stoning.
And after quoting Deuteronomy, our scholar adds this in brackets.
It's interesting to note here that when the Pharisees dragged an adulteress to Jesus and wanted to stone her, they had already broken the law themselves by letting the man get away.
An interesting note indeed. And then the Pharisees ask Jesus what he has to say about this case of adultery. But he says nothing, just bends down and writes with his finger on the ground. A recognised way, we're told, of indicating that one wished to take no part in the conversation, an invitation to the others to go away. But they don't go away and insist with their question. Then Jesus utters those celebrated words which have passed into language and become proverbial. Let him that is without sin cast the first stone. Again he bends down and writes again on the ground. This action has apparently been seen by some scholars as an allusion to some words of Jeremiah referring to the temple and the Lord.
All who abandon you will be put to shame. All who turn from you will be uprooted from the land, written in the dust.
Although the episode of the woman taken in adultery is accepted as authentic by the scholars, it's uncertain which of the evangelists actually wrote it. A note in the Jerusalem Bible reads,
"The author of this passage is not John. The oldest manuscripts do not include it or place it elsewhere. The style is that of the synoptics."
And in fact, another scholar notes that some codices put it in Luke's Gospel. Whoever reported the incident, however, its teaching is crystal clear. Jesus did not deny the law, nor the fault. But instead of looking at the situation from a legal viewpoint, he shifted the emphasis to a moral one. "And the moral sense of the Jews," writes Bargellini, "even that of the scribes and Pharisees, was such that they could not but apprehend the profound truth of those words. And so, one by one, they melted away. Where are they? Has no one condemned you? No one, sir. Neither do I condemn you. Go away and don't sin any more." And Bargellini concludes,
"Only he, the innocent one, could have condemned her, and only one who had the power to condemn her could also pardon her, making mercy triumph over justice, which is the perfect justice of God."